Nadeem Aslam is an award-winning British novelist. He was born in Pakistan. He set his latest novel in post-9/11 Afghanistan. It's called The Wasted Vigil. Alan Chews has this review.
Afghanistan, in this new novel, is a vast field of human misery, physical distress, and wounds both physical and psychic inflicted by the Taliban and the warlords who have taken over in their wake. A number of fascinating characters gather in a villa in the countryside near a town currently being fought over by two warlords. Each has a quest. Each is essentially thwarted by circumstance and history. Marcus, a one-handed British physician who, with his late wife, viciously murdered by the Taliban, attended for decades to the needs of the local population. David, a pensive former CIA agent. And finally, Kasa, an Islamic fanatic, passing as a casualty of war. So the perspective from this novelist about contemporary Afghanistan is enlightening if given to pessimism. As David, the ex-spy, meditates on the subject, what did they, the Americans, really know about such parts of the world, of the layer upon layer of savagery that made them up? They had arrived in these places without realizing how fragile were the defenses that most people had erected against cruelty and degradation here, conducting a life with the light of a firefly. Nadeem Aslam's light shines much more brightly, but the misery, religious murders, and hypocrisy, fear, and hopelessness it revealed was almost more than I could take. Aslam's window onto Islamic fundamentalism and the mores of contemporary Afghanistan, the colors of life there, the intensity of death. Have you read The Kite Runner? This novel makes that book seem like a Hallmark greeting card.
The Wasted Vigil is by British writer Nadeem Aslam. Our reviewer is Alan Chews.
In the beginning, the U.S. revolted against the British crown. More recently, Britain provided large numbers of troops and considerable support for the U.S. war in Iraq when other European allies were reluctant. That's presumably one way to look at what the two countries call a special relationship. Another way would be the frequently quoted, two countries divided by a common language. George Bernard Shaw said that. Sarah Lyle offers us clueless Yanks some help with our special friends. She's an American journalist who's written a field guide to the British called the Anglophiles. That's two words. She joins us now. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
Now, I thought your book would be like a nonstop romp through the sillier parts of British culture, and some of it certainly is that. But I did not expect to find some of it verging on tragic, like your account of the Brits and booze.
It's a huge problem in British society now, the drinking themselves into oblivion. And it's, you know, it's a flip side of their sort of conviviality, I think. They don't kind of sit quietly with a glass of wine and just chat. You know, the idea is to get as drunk as you can as quickly as possible for as little money as possible.
You kind of blend drunkenness and politics in this book. You explain to us that the parliament is substantially well-lit most of the time.
Well, not most of the time. When they debate late into the evening, there's a tradition of people going out to restaurants, or there's a lot of bars actually in the parliament building.
I think you said there's 17 ways to buy liquor in the parliament building?
17 different places you can buy liquor. Sometimes you just, you know, you can buy bottles of stuff and take them home that say House of Commons on them or House of Lords. And they come back, and for the late night sessions, it's not, you know, unheard of for people to be debating, you know, in a more merry state than they would have had it been the middle of the day.
You tell a hilarious story about George Brown, who's a Labour politician of loving memory.
Yeah, he was known for enjoying a glass or two, and the idea was you had to kind of get him before lunch, because after lunch he wasn't necessarily at his best. The story goes that he was at a reception for visiting Peruvian dignitaries, and he lurched up to a guest who was prettily attired in flowing purple robes and asked for a dance. "First, you are drunk," the guest replied. "Second, this is not a waltz. It is the Peruvian national anthem. And third, I am not a woman. I am the Cardinal Archbishop of Lima."
I must say, I totally love that. You point out that British newspapers are generally much livelier than ours are, and that British journalists view American newspapers as prudish, overly concerned with facts, basically boring. But You write in your book that they have adopted one custom of American journalism, and that is to print corrections.
Yeah, it was a new innovation in the last decade or so. The Guardian newspaper particularly said, you know, we're going to take this seriously and we're going to correct the mistakes we've made because it's disgraceful that newspapers have gotten away with not correcting their mistakes. And The Guardian has always been kind of lampooned as a newspaper that gets a lot of things wrong. In private eye, it's referred to as the Groniad, you know, misspelling of its own name. And so some of the corrections are really quite amusing.
This is page 58, 59. Could you maybe read us a few of those corrections?
For some people, this is the favorite part of the newspaper. They turn immediately to the corrections column. Once the corrections column printed a correction admitting that it had spelled misspelled twice in a single week. Here are some other examples. The great crested newt shown on the front of the society section was, on sober inspection, upside down. We prematurely knighted John Scarlett for the 13th time. And finally, yesterday was Wednesday, despite an assertion that it was once again Tuesday.
We don't even do corrections like in that way. You also deal with strange spelling, which of course would be ridiculous on the radio, but you talk about the game of cricket, which makes baseball look like a simple, rational game. Bad British teeth, Princess Diana worship, how to tell one glass from another. Do you think that after looking into all of these sometimes very amusing aspects of British institutions and British behavior, do you think you can now sum up the British character?
No, it's impossible to sum up. That's the thing. They really defy description. And they themselves have been trying to sum up the British character in a kind of interesting government exercise in recent years. The government's been worried that there isn't enough cohesion in the society. This is because of Muslim immigration and kind of Scottish nationalism. So the government has been trying to get the people to think about what it means to be British. And they decided to do this exercise where they would formulate a statement of values. And they asked for people to give their opinion on what these should be. Mm-hmm. And this being Britain, everyone immediately ridiculed the proposal and said, it's ridiculous. We don't want to have to define ourselves. And the Times newspaper of London decided to do a motto competition. And people submitted entries like, at least we're not French. Pardon the inconvenience. And the winning caption was, no motto, please, we're British. And the man who submitted that said, I can't think of anything less British than having to say why you're British.
Do you like it there? You moved to England because you married a British citizen.
Yes. My husband is British and my kids are British now, too. I love it. It's a very interesting place to live. And I think the differences make, you know, for a very lively time because it's you know, as a reporter, you're always looking at things with a bit of remove anyway. And so, you know, it's great to live somewhere for so long and really be able to get inside some of these issues that seem perplexing.
Do you think you've done it?
No, I think it's going to take at least 20 more years. A lifetime of study, maybe.
Sarah Lyle is the author of The Anglophiles, A Field Guide to the British. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I am Neda Ulaby. This week on NPR's podcast, Book Tour, we'll hear author Andrew Davidson read from his new novel, The Gargoyle. It's a mystical romance involving time travel, stone carving, and a porn star turned burn victim contemplating suicide.
I had an excellent plan, and it made me smile. It made me drift more lightly on my air flotation bed. I was an unbeloved monster. No one would mourn my loss. For all intents and purposes, I was already gone. Who would miss me?
For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction, please visit npr.org/booktour. If popular culture has decided that suburban housewives are desperate, what about their husbands? Guys obsessed with keeping the lawns manicured and steaks grilled. Paula Wyman is a writer and housewife, although she's not desperate. And she's been thinking about those guys for our series, three books. She recommends these three novels.
People are always talking about desperate housewives. But as someone who's a stay-at-home mom, when I pick up a book, I don't always want a primer on my own thoughts. I like to know what men are thinking. These three books are my passports into the mind and soul of the desperate suburban man. Let's start with Judith Guest's Ordinary People. You might remember the distant cold mother from the movie, but in the book, the center of this troubled family is really the father, Cal Jarrett. Cal provides his family with new cars and fancy vacations, but he doesn't have a clue about their emotional needs. His wife thinks feelings should be hidden. Their son, who's recovering from a suicide attempt, needs to express his feelings in order to heal. Mother and son clash, and Cal, the father, is caught in the middle. But there is hope. His attempts to connect with his son are bumbling at times, but that makes him endearing and real. Frank Bascom is also endearing and real. He's the hero of Richard Ford's Independence Day. A realtor, Frank is a funny, insightful tour guide to his New Jersey town, but he's not so competent when it comes to relationships. His ex-wife is marrying a rich preppy, and Frank's hopes for a reunion are gone like a fart in a skillet. He's not doing so well with his teenage son either. During a father-son trip, Frank abandons the boy to flirt with an innkeeper. And then there's the realty business. Frank loves his work, but his latest client has rejected more than 40 houses. In his frustration, Frank gives a hilarious description of the guy's obscene bike shorts. Bascom may screw up almost every relationship, but he's fun to watch. His self-deprecating wit and easygoing nature makes me want to stick around, even when his wife doesn't. So do these desperate suburban men start out as desperate teenage boys? If so, maybe they'll recognize Edwin Hanratty, the misfit at the center of Jim Shepherd's Project X. In a voice full of humor, sadness, and longing, Edwin leads us through his tortured school days. He's ridiculed by teachers and beaten by bullies. "No more malt shop for me," Edwin says sarcastically when his father grounds him for a fight he didn't start. When Edwin can't take it anymore, he and his only friend plan a Columbine-style massacre. Will he really go through with it? Edwin's so likable and tragically misguided, I'm rooting for him right to the end. They may not be the best companions in life, but on the page, these forlorn suburban men and their valiant, sometimes funny, sometimes heartbreaking struggles keep me, a not-so-desperate housewife, fully absorbed in their angst.
Paula Wyman lives in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. She was recommending Ordinary People by Judith Guest, Independence Day by Richard Ford, and Project X by Jim Shepherd. If you are desperate for more book recommendations, plus reviews and author readings, you can visit the books section of our website, npr.org.
In 1980, when the actor Robert Wagner turned 50, his wife Natalie Wood threw a surprise party for him. And the guest list tells you the way that Wagner was connected to an earlier age in Hollywood. That guest list included Robert Mitchum, Gene Kelly, Esther Williams, and Henry Fonda. Robert Wagner has written a memoir about his years in that Hollywood, and NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg read it.
When he was 12 in 1942, Robert John Wagner had a crush on the movies. He lived in Bel Air near the golf club. Young R.J. sat under a cluster of trees watching the players. One day, he spotted some golfers leaving the 11th hole.
Those men were Clark Gable, Fred Astaire, Cary Grant, and Jimmy Stewart. I was just transfixed.
In his memoir, Pieces of My Heart, written with Scott Eyman, Robert Wagner says that day he saw his future passing in front of him.
And I just said to myself, oh, boy, would I love to be part of that group. Would I love to be an actor? Would I love to have that feeling that I had, in seeing them?
Well, he became part of that group a few years later, largely because of another movie icon of the day, Barbara Stanwyck.
Just been taking a sun bath.
Here with Fred McMurray in Double Indemnity.
Now, about those policies, Mr. Diedrichsen, I hate to take up your time, but...
Oh, that's all right. If you wait till I put something on, I'll be right down.
Stanhook was a huge star, 4-time Oscar nominee, hardworking, generous. Wagner met her when they were shooting Titanic, the 1953 version, before Leonardo DiCaprio was born. Stanhook was 45, Wagner was 22. She was his first big love, and in their 4 years together in Hollywood after the war, he became friends with her friends, Clark Gable, Gary Cooper, and importantly, a father figure he would make two pictures with, Spencer Tracy.
He put his arm around me, and he really felt that I could be somebody. You know, before that, I was, you know, pretty much just a good-looking kid. There were so many of us around.
Tracy thought the kid had talent, a big boost to Wagner's confidence. He also got to know Katharine Hepburn. Wagner's first daughter, Katie, is named for that great star. So, all these marquee pals. Betty Davis, he ended up organizing her memorial service. And he seemed so modest, unegotistical. Sometimes you can almost hear him blush. What was it about you, Robert Wagner? You were gorgeous, you were young, you were winning, you were funny. They liked you.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing for you to say. I that's one of the reasons that I wrote this book, because I had to acknowledge these people who have been so wonderful to me over my life.
And, but I hear how modest you are, too. Listen to you. You're embarrassed that I gave that string of adjectives, huh?
Well, but it's these people made the difference in my life. They really did.
Actress Natalie Wood made a major difference. They married in 1957 in New York. She was 19, he 27. A car dealer in Chicago offered them a Corvette. The newlyweds began driving home to Los Angeles.
We put the radio on, and it was picked up that we were driving across the United States. And so the radio, the disc jockey or whoever we were listening to that particular time, he said, Natalie Wood and Robert Wagner are driving across the country. They're on I-90 just outside of Lubbock or wherever it was. And suddenly all these kids came out and they were tailing us and trailing us and wishing us good luck. And, oh, it was so terrific. It was great.
But the marriage went flat. They divorced and remarried one another in 1972. Wagner writes movingly of Natalie Wood's death by drowning in 1981. Mysteries and rumors surrounded her death. Wagner believes she slipped off their boat while trying to secure a dinghy in dark, rough seas. All those friends he'd accumulated in Hollywood helped Wagner and his children get through their darkness. Work helped, too, in films and on TV, although that took some arm twisting. In 1968, Lou Wasserman, head of Universal, had a script written for Wagner.
And I said to him, I said, you know, Lou, I really don't want to be a television actor. I'm a movie actor. He said, look, if it doesn't work, I'll make a movie out of it for you, and you're covered both ways. But I think this is your medium.
It was. He starred as Alexander Mundy in the series It Takes a Thief. Mundy, a debonair professional thief, won his freedom by helping the government catch spies. His father, also a thief, was played by Wagner's longtime friend, Fred Astaire.
Well, supposing you successfully steal this $10 million, how much of it will you get?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Yeah, nothing.
What is this world coming to?
It Takes a Thief was a tremendous hit. So was a later TV series, Heart to Heart, with Wagner and Stephanie Powers as millionaire sleuths out for lots of good times.
Don't you remember? I almost majored in archaeology with a minor in anthropology.
Anthropology? Oh, yeah, that's the study of man. As a member of the species, I have to tell you, you've been neglecting your studies lately.
In the 70s and early 80s, Robert Wagner was a big TV star, but he drew the line at playing cops. He writes, I never wanted to play any character that could conceivably yell, freeze, police.
It's like being on a doctor's show, you know? You don't want to be the doctor. You want to be the patient. Because the patient's always got the better part.
But often the patient is anesthetized.
Yes, but if you're the smart actor, you say, take the needle out of my arm.
Robert J. Wagner. Most recently, in his 60-year career, he's appeared as number two in the Austin Powers films. In his memoir, Pieces of My Heart, Wagner writes this about the joys and responsibilities of his profession. Millions of people arrange their lives so that they can watch actors who mean something to them. Robert Wagner has meant much to many fans. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
More about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.